Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
And a very good evening and welcome along to Sunshine Meets. For the next hour, we're going to be in the company of a former Eurovision winner, former politician, former MEP, Dana. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, we do this with all our guests and we ask them to tell us, first of all, a little bit about your life growing up, where you're from, because there are obviously some people who may not know an awful lot about your early life.
Well, I'm born of Irish parents. They were both from Derry City. And then after the war, my father went to look for work in London, where his brother had gone before him. And when he found a job, my mother moved over, and three of our family were already born at that time. In fact, four were already born. So I was born in London. We lived in Islington. And I actually have memories of that time. It was a Georgian bomb-damaged house. And it had steps up to the front door and railings around the front. And I remember, as a child, sitting on the kitchen floor. And as I got a little bit older, I remember playing with a little girl across the street whose name was Loopy Lou. And then we moved back to Ireland, back to Derry, when I was around about five.
What year was this?
That would have been around about somewhere in between 55, 56, 57, somewhere in that region. I was either five or six. My grandmother, of course, my mother's mother lived in what became known as the Bogside, but it was a little street off Roswell Street called Union Street. And then we moved to this new estate that was being built on the hill overlooking Derry City, and that new estate was the Creggan.
And did you have any sense of the problems that were going to be lying ahead as far as the troubles were when you were sort of growing up, or did your parents get any sense of that?
I didn't get any sense of it because it was a very, and still is a very, musical city. And I think because there was never work for men really in Derry. My father was a barber and he had a barber shop with his brother, Johnny Brown, in Roswell Street, in fact. That would have been back in the, well, maybe the 40s. And when I was growing up, I mean, my life revolved around music because my father was a fine trumpet player. There was a big brass band tradition in Derry, and he was about 5 years old, he was in St. Columb's brass and reed band. And his father was, and his grandfather was. So a lot of the men in Derry were trained in music, reading music, from they were very young in a brass band. And then, of course, he went on to play in dance bands, and he had his own dance bands. So our house was always musicians coming and going, mm-hmm. full of music. Mm-hmm. It was the kind of city where, you know, when I got into my teens, like we're all night owls, you know, anybody who's involved in music is a night owl. So I'd be out visiting my friends, I'd be leaving their home at maybe between 11 and 12 o'clock at night. I'd walk home perfectly safe through the city, never having to look behind me. So it was a very friendly, creative city. So no, I didn't anticipate. And my mum and dad, half my father's family were Protestant. And so they, I think, made every effort that we would never think them and us. So they used to take us down to the Orange Men's Parades. I mean, until I was a teenager, I and maybe a little earlier than a teenager, I thought it was Catholic Parade.
Yes.
I had no idea. But we loved the bands and we'd go out and watch. And actually, my father tells us about his cousin Jack Jameson, who was living in Glasgow. And he used to come over because he was an Orangeman. He used to march in the parades. And he stayed with my father's family. They lived right opposite the convent in Pump Street, in the middle of the city. And just at the bottom of the street, if you turned left, you were in the Diamond where the parades began. And he used to come over with his sash and his bowler hat. And my grandfather, whom I never met, his name was Johnny Brown, he used to say to him, if you put that hat on your head before you turn the corner and out of the view of the convent, you'll have no head to put it on tomorrow. So my father was very close to Jack Jameson. And when I won Eurovision, actually, I think I was probably the only Catholic artist that did a week in the Rangers Club in Glasgow, because Jack was the manager of the Rangers Club.
Wow, wow. And that's extraordinary because, yes, there were big, big divides in those days, but I don't think it became exaggerated then that once the trouble started, because I think there was a big tolerance. Can you see us getting back to where that situation was? Because it's still kind of a bit tricky at the moment in the north, isn't it?
Well, I can't ignore the fact that there was definitely discrimination against the Catholic, in many cases the majority in the city, and there was gerrymandering of votes, and I cannot deny that that happened. It absolutely happened. But on the grassroots level, a lot of the Protestant working class people were in as difficult a position as the Catholic working class in our town, and music brought us together. We'd facias, won all Irish every year in Derry Columbkill. We'd won the Londonderry face, which was all classical and ballet, both of which I did. So I took part in both facias. In fact, most of the community did. And that stopped the fierce divide that you saw perhaps in bigger communities like in Belfast. So we mingled more and intermingled more. So I can't deny that there was really discrimination against, and I think that's what's given me like most Irish people, I have a fierce desire that people will be heard, you know, that there shouldn't be discrimination or repression. And I see, obviously, changes for the better in the north. And of course, although they fell into two religious divides, it's always at the bottom of it about money and power. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where in the world there's that discrimination and repression. It may fall into religious groups or political groups, but normally at the bottom of it, it's about money and power. And the Good Friday Agreement has greatly helped in the north in making sure that there's representation. But all the political moves in the world mean nothing if the hearts of the people don't go with it. And actually, I think the hearts of the people were leading the political, world as far as peace in the north.
Okay, so as we approach 1970, which is Eurovision time, I won't say you were a seasoned musician, but you were reasonably experienced. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I certainly, we'd have musical evenings in our house. It was a regular occurrence. I mean, musicians would come in maybe after playing in the bar or wherever. They'd come in at 12 o'clock at night. My mother was always sitting at the piano. They'd lift a guitar. I mean, they had sessions that went on to 3 in the morning. That was very normal. But also with my friends, I was very interested in folk music. So it was American folk and Irish folk. So we'd go to each other's houses. We'd sing, we'd play guitar. Of course, we all fell in love with the Beatles. Sometimes we'd just go and listen to their music. And those kind of evenings were perfectly normal for me. So I began singing as a singer. It wasn't my main instrument. My main instrument was the piano. And I studied classical piano. But I was to do a duo in a talent competition. We had a big talent competition every year in Derry. It was founded and it was run by Father Daly. Do you remember who became Bishop Daly?
That's right.
That iconic picture of the priest with the blood-stained handkerchief on Bloody Sunday.
Never to be forgotten.
Well, since I was like 5 or 6 years of age, I knew Father Daly. and I knew of Father Daly. And my dancing partner took sick, couldn't do it, and I went to Father Daly to get my pound back because we were in the novelty centre section. So he said, "Well, sure, you sing, don't you?" He said, "Don't you play the guitar?" Which I did. And he said, "I'll put you in the folk section." It took me about 30 years to realise he just didn't want to give me the pound back. But I came second, and I did another competition, and I came first, and I won the chance to record in Dublin with a record company called Rex Records. So at weekends, after school on a Friday, I'd go in a car to Dublin, and I sang in the folk venues, the old Sheeling, Crofton Airport Hotel. Do you remember the hotel that was under the bridge? There was a, I see it clearly in my mind, it was a big folk venue. You went downstairs and there was no air, no windows.
The lower deck, was it?
Yeah, no, it wasn't called the lower deck. It was actually a hotel. The name might come to me. But
whereabouts was it? What part of Dublin?
Jeepers, I can see it clearly, but and I can't tell you the name of the street, but there was a railway bridge over it.
Okay.
And it was just under the railway bridge. Maybe some of the listeners
might
remember.
Wasn't the North Star Hotel, was it?
No.
No, on the...
But it'll come back to me. Yeah. And the Green Isle Hotel. So yes. I was singing on alongside people like the Dubliners and We Four, and I can't remember the name of the other. My head's away.
Well, there was the Johnstons with Paul Brady was around the same time, I think.
I think the Johnstons were there. I'm not absolutely sure. Of course, I knew of the Johnstons. But
and the Emmett Spiceland.
Emmett Spiceland, whom I loved then and still love now.
Yeah, Donna Lunny, yes.
Yeah. So I was very lucky. I mean, I was way down the bill, but I was singing and getting experience in Clontarf Castle. So that led to me being entered for the auditions for the National Song Contest in 1969.
And I'm going to talk to you about that now because I need to take a little break. But before we do take a little break, I want to talk to you about some music and maybe something that you enjoyed or informed you or something you would enjoy in your early years or teenage years. Is there any particular song?
Well, there were so many pieces of music and records and things that bring back memories to me. There's one that I can't bring back the memory of what it is, but when I hear it, I'm kind of in a zone. I just love it. So it obviously triggers something inside of me. And it's called Mr. Tambourine Man by the Birds.
Senses have been stripped, and my hands can't feel to grip, and my toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere, I'm ready for to fade onto my own parade. Cast your dancing spell my way. I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there ain't no place I'm going to. Following you.
Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
And welcome back. You're listening to Sunshine Meets. And our special guest this evening is Dana, former Eurovision winner, former politician. Dana, you entered and represented Ireland in the Eurovision Song Contest in 1970. And we talked in the first part about the troubles in Northern Ireland. You managed, I'm guessing, successfully to navigate around that while that was full blown and still represent Ireland. Tell us, first of all, how that came about.
Well, I'd won a record contract with a little company in Dublin called Rex Records. They were actually a distributing company for Decca. But the founder of it, Michael Gagan, he wanted to give Irish artists a chance to record because it was nearly impossible to get a recording deal in London with the big, you know, the big labels. And I recorded with him. And the secretary of the company said, I'm going to enter you for auditions for the Irish National Song Contest. They'd opened it up to amateurs and semi-pros because all the pros had already sung for the country. So I got the bus down from Derry. I auditioned. And I was accepted. And in 1969, I came second. But it was a terrifying experience for me. I'd never
Who won the national contest in 69?
Muriel Day.
Ah, Muriel Day.
Wages of Love.
That's right.
And, I mean, I was so glad.
I never realised that now. There, I learn something new every day, that you were actually in the contest. That
I was. And I think if I'd won, I would have died of fright because I was so nervous. And I retired from singing that summer. I thought, I can't do this for my life. I get too nervous. And then Tom McGrath, do you remember Tom McGrath?
Worked in RTE.
He was head of Light Entertainment. Very laid back, very droll. Always kind of chewing on a pipe. He called me up before Christmas and he said, he used to call me Rosie Mary. He said, I have this little song for the 1970 National Song Contest. I think it would suit you. Would you sing it? So I was only months away from my A-levels and the career that I wanted, which was to be a teacher. I wanted to teach music and English literature. So I had to get permission to do it. I was that close to the practicals. And I talked it through with my parents and my teachers, and basically it was to be the last hurrah. It would be the last thing I'd ever do of that kind. So I took part in the National Song Contest. I won it. And then I went to Amsterdam. And, of course, that changed my life. All kinds of everything.
And had you any idea of the impact it was going to have? Because the impact in Ireland and in every household where we were in, you know, one-channel land, two-channel land, that sort of stuff, and where there wasn't the, you know, social media fragmentation of all the different stuff, the impact was absolutely huge.
Yeah, I had never, not for one second did I ever think I would win it or the song would win it. Never. So it was, I think, you know, I was in shock for about 6 months, and that's the truth. I was in shock.
And some homecoming in Derry.
Oh, yes, starting in Dublin first. When we went to Amsterdam, my mum and my granny went with me, and we were waved off by two lovely cleaning ladies and a porter. And we landed back in Dublin Airport with my name on the side of the plane, Operation Dana. In fact, the new Aer Lingus calendar has that photograph in it.
Wow.
And there must have been 5,000 people hanging off the terminal building. Oh, it was unbelievable.
You thought the Beatles had arrived.
Oh, my God, it was terrible. It was just, I couldn't believe it. Then, for the first time in the history of our nation, an Irish plane flew into UK airspace because we landed in Ballykelly Airport outside of Derry. And then I went by car with the head of the council into Derry. And we got fairly close to the Guildhall. And we couldn't get through the street with the people. There was thousands of people. And I was carried shoulder high to the steps of the Guildhall, where I'd walked in so many times in my life when I was 6 years old to sing in the Fage. And I was just carried shoulder high across the people and landed on the steps.
I suppose when you think about it, the news had been so dour from, you know, that part of the world, and this was an amazing thing to happen and a possibility of uniting communities and stuff like that.
Oh, it was so needed. I mean, there were very dark days in Derry and in the north, and there were hard days here too in the south. You know, there were hard days, the 70s, and I think it was just a little ray of light. And certainly I can speak for the people in Derry. It was a chance to show the world, this is the real us, you know, the music. And not the running battles that were photographed on every newspaper and every newsreel throughout the world.
So at that stage, did you have any sense that pop music was going to be your career for, you know, the foreseeable future? Or did you think, well, this was a one-off, that's great, and we'll all settle down and I'll get back to teaching?
I didn't think it would be my career. I thought I would be able to go back and do my A-levels. I mean, I'd been 7 years studying at that point and so close to doing it. But of course, that was impossible because it caught the imagination of every European country. We had three European television crews camped on the landing of our flat. I couldn't get out the door. And there were more at my school.
Wow.
So it was impossible for me to go back without completely disrupting, you know, the girls who were going into their O-levels and their A-levels and their junior certs. It was impossible.
So what happened?
I just was on a whirlwind of... First thing we did was an Irish tour because I was committed to that.
Did you finish your A-levels?
Oh, no. No.
Never?
I couldn't go back.
You're thinking of going back now? To do them
when
now?
I had all my voice problems, I thought, well, I'll just go back now and I'll pick up and I'll teach piano perhaps at that point. But no, I couldn't go back. So it was sometimes three countries in one day. And, you know, you always hear the one-hit wonder. Well, I couldn't see any reason why I'd be any different. But we were directed by Michael Gagan to talk with different manager agents in London. And I signed, actually, funnily enough, my agent was a wonderful musician himself. His name was Dick Katz. And he said to me, I don't believe in contracts. He said, it's only ink on a page. If you're not happy with me or I'm not happy with you, what's the point of a contract? What a lesson for me. And he represented everyone, all the big stars. He was Jimi Hendrix's manager agent. He died just before I came into the company. Oh. And he was wonderful to work with, you know. So the best thing that happened to me was the next single was a flop. It was called I Will Follow You. And you know who did the demo for that was Olivia Newton-John.
Wow.
That was the first time I met Olivia. She's always remained a really lovely person, you know, good person. So that was a flop. And I went into his office. He was just off Bond Street. And he said, well, now, he said, you can go back to normal life. He said, and nobody will think the worse of you. Or you can stay and fight. So I thought about it for a minute. I said, OK, I'll stay and fight. And the next single, which came out coinciding with Eurovision of 1971, was Who Put the Lights Out? And that was in the charts all over Europe. So it kind of, it helped me greatly because I wasn't the one-hit wonder from the year before. I had a hit record when I handed on the prize that year.
Okay, that's amazing. Did you find the business tough, by the way? Did you find it unforgiving?
I didn't, because I loved what I was doing. And being a musician myself, my father was a musician. He travelled with me.
And were you making money?
Well, I wouldn't have been making what they're making today. No. But yes, you were making money, enough to buy a house in London. And I suppose I was the provider at that point in my family because my father was working with me. And he had his hairdressing business. We moved from the Craigan to what's known as the Bogside because he opened a barber and hairdressing shop in the ground floor of the Roswell Street flats. That's why we moved down there. But then with all the bombings and the riots, all those shops closed. So, you know, he worked with me, travelled with me, which was great for me.
And did the family move out of Derry?
We moved to London the year after one of my brothers went to college in Manchester and then in London. But my younger brother, he had gone to live with an uncle in London, more or less fairly early on in the Troubles, because coming back from school one day, he got caught up in a running riot in the street. And my mother said, that's enough of that. So he was in London anyway. So, yes, I bought a house in London about 1973, around about that period. Yeah. But moving in there in 74, I think it was 74 maybe. It's an amazing, I forget the years. But when I moved to GTO, it was an independent label. And there was only a small roster. There was me. There was Heat Wave. Do you remember Boogie Nights?
Yeah, I do. I remember Heat Wave. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Fox, Donna Summer, and David Cassidy. That was it. Oh. And David, Red Light. Da da da.
What was the song? Go again.
Red Light. He did.
Oh, Billy Ocean. That's it.
Billy. And we were all in one little building, and you know, it was like a family. So we all knew each other. We were all starting off with this new label. And I made some great friends that have kept all my life. And one of them, in fact, was Rod Temperton. Rod was the main writer with Heatwave.
Oh, Heatwave, yeah. But he did stuff with the Temptations as well.
He did something for everybody.
Yeah.
He wrote Thriller for Michael Jackson.
Of course.
And most of the tracks on that album. And for another favourite singer of mine, if we get to pick another song, I'll tell you what it is. But very lucky with GTO. I was lucky because the man who founded it, Dick Leahy, had an ear for hit records. And not only that, he didn't just put something out and if it didn't go like that, he'd drop it. He persevered. So we had Please Tell Him I Said Hello and we had Cold Cold Christmas and Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. And
what year was Cold Cold Christmas?
75.
Yeah. Wow. And still gets played.
Yes, it does. So we did a wonderful song called Fairy Tale, and it was produced by Barry Blue. And Barry was also producing Heatwave. And it was an amazing song. He used an electric violin at the beginning of it, which was a totally different sound. It was almost a disco, very different for me. Yeah. And I went up to Manchester to do my first television. Open my mouth, I couldn't sing. So that evening, I was with the consultant, and the following morning, he was operating because I had a growth on one of my vocal cords. And he didn't know if it was cancer or not. But to remove it, thank God it wasn't cancerous, but to remove it, he had to take a piece out of the cord because he had to cut the root out. And it took me 5 years to get back. But during that period, when it was so difficult to get over the fear, never mind the physical, Rod was living in Los Angeles because he was working with Quincy Jones and he was writing for everybody. And we were going out to Los Angeles and I told him, and he said, come up to the house. He said, I have a studio in the house and I have a couple of songs and we'll record them and don't worry about it. If only, I remember his words, if only the village clock hears it, don't worry. So he lived in Mulholland Drive above Beverly Hills and we went up and he had a beautiful studio in his home. And I stood in front of the microphone and I was nervous, you know, but I knew him so well and he was the loveliest person you could meet. I said, oh, this is fantastic, a studio in your home. He said, yeah, it's great. He says, Michael McDonald was singing there last night. Well, I wish the floor would open up and I could fall through it because I'm a massive fan of Michael McDonald. I think he's one of the unique, beautiful voices. And of course, his time with the Doobie Brothers was amazing, but on his own, I love his music. Mm. So we did the songs and I can't tell you how sad it is that we lost Rod Temperton recently. He died unnecessarily young of cancer.
I know, it's a scourge. It's a scourge.
Yeah.
Dana, we're going to pause there and we're going to get your second piece of music because we'll take a little break and then I'm going to talk to you about, find out if you're mad or not because you left the pop or the music business to go into politics and I need to find out if the reason you did that. But before we do that, your second piece of music, please.
Well, my second piece of music combines two people that I love very much. One of them is Michael McDonald.
You've just spoken about
him. The other one is Ra Temperton because he wrote Sweet Freedom.
Okay.
And just to tell you the kind of man Rod was, I sang it on a television special I was doing in England. And he called me to tell me how much he appreciated that I sang his song.
Wow.
Just one of life's beautiful people.
Fantastic. Well, listen, that is a great way to lead into this. And this, as you say, Michael McDonald, what a voice. And this is Sweet Freedom.
Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 101.
106.8. And welcome back. You're listening to Sunshine Meets. It's Joe Harrington here. My special guest this Sunday evening is Dana, former Eurovision winner, which we've spoken about. All the various pop connections she had with some of the, I suppose, the elite of people in the pop world, Dana. And then, for some reason, you decided to go into politics. Were you mad or what? I mean, what was your reason to get into politics? You became an MEP. Before that, you went to try and become president of Ireland. And I think a lot of candidates in that found it very, very bruising. So tell us a little bit about your experience.
I didn't intend to get into politics, you know. And I saw politics fail in the North. And I switched off completely from politics. I didn't want to listen to the news. I didn't want to know. And then we were actually living in America, and I got a letter asking would I speak on behalf of people who felt that nobody was listening. And I thought, well, they're crazy for a start off, because they were asking me to put my name forward for nomination for the presidency. And I said no. I said, in fact, I wouldn't even say no directly. I just sent word back in case they'd think I was acknowledging it. Then they were going to fly over to speak to me. And I said to Damien, oh, my God, these people are crazy. Next thing, there was a headline in a newspaper that I was thinking of running for the presidency. And we were in.
Just remind people what year that was.
97. But to make a long story short, the more I looked at it, first of all, it's always a very wrong thing if people who don't have influence feel that nobody listens to them. That's a very bad thing. And the next thing was I learned that you couldn't be nominated for the presidency at that time, although others had tried, unless you had the backing of a political party. But of course, the presidency belongs to the people of Ireland. I read the Constitution from cover to cover. I thought I'll underline what's important here. I underlined every page, because the people decide on the presidency. The people decide on any changes to their constitution. That's very unique. So I thought, well, that's not right, that you can only have the keys to the park if a political party allows you. So I mean, it was just me and my family. We just rented a van. I went up and down the country to challenge the status quo. And I didn't think I'd get nominated. But because I'd come from America, because I was so well known in England and Europe, there were eyes from outside watching what was happening. And that was a different situation from previous. I was an independent. From previous people who had tried to do it, where they were only known within the country. America was watching. It was all over CBS. It was of interest. And I think that's part of the reason why I was the first independent to be nominated. And then quickly followed by another independent who was running, which I was delighted about. So I just had a platform and I just spoke what I heard people saying, and then I came in third place. I got a massive vote, but I thought, oh, I can go back to normal life now.
Did you find it bruising? I mean, because the problem is that once you put your head above the parapet, there's all sorts of people go into your background, go into your personal beliefs, go into your faith, go into everything. And, for a lot of people, that can be a private thing. And then you have to explain to everyone why you're thinking this and why you're thinking that. And was that difficult?
Well, yes, it's difficult. And that first campaign, the sarcasm and the ridicule, and I mean, that was harder for my children to read. I'd never been in that kind of situation before. Listen, if people don't like your music, that's their prerogative. But if people suddenly hate you as a person because of what they think you are or what they think you believe, that's hurtful.
Isn't that the problem now with social media, that people are, without having the full facts of anything, are putting all sorts of vitriol on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on these various social media platforms?
It's very sad. And there's a lot of anger out there, and a lot of frustration. And, you know, people have, their trust has been undermined. So perhaps something in us is looking to be let down, you know, we look to be let down. And then when it happens, there's anger and hurt. But, you know, I remember I remember my, I was so relieved to see my little mum at Dublin Airport. And as an adult, there's not that many times when you suddenly think, oh God, I'm so glad my mum's there.
Yes.
And I was so glad to see her wee face. And she travelled everywhere with me and gave me such strength. But, you know, I really thought after the election I would go back to normal life with my family. But it had brought together a whole lot of people. I wouldn't be connected with any party or any funding because I wanted to make like a clearing in the forest where people could come if they wanted. Jonathan Philbin Bowman was a great support to me. He wouldn't have agreed with me on hardly anything, but he agreed on my right to have the right to say it.
Yes.
You know?
Let me just ask you, Dana, about some people who would perceive or would say you might have controversial views on whether it be same-sex marriage or other areas, in that general areas. And have you kind of ever kind of reflected and thought, well, maybe my viewpoint could change to understand that, you know, in God's eyes, all people are equal, or, you know, what are your views?
I've never thought anything but that.
Okay.
And anything that I upheld was within the Irish Constitution. And I always upheld that if it was ever to be changed, it would be the people themselves who would decide. Of course, there are positions and beliefs that I have, but they don't make me judge anybody else. And, you know, it's some of the most compassionate, kindest and longest friendships in my life have been with homosexual men. My dearest
and would you still friendships. Hold, would you still hold the same belief that you don't think two men should be married or two women should be married?
Well, it's a very deep conversation to get into right here and to cover in 2 minutes.
No, I know.
And I have friends who are same-sex and married, and they believe that that is completely fine. And I have same-sex friends who do not believe that it should be marriage as such, but they believe in civil partnerships. Mm-hmm. So even within the gay community, there are different opinions.
That. Yeah. I understand that. Yeah. No, I just wondered if you know, when you reflect back on stuff and you see, because this country has seriously changed in the last 10, 15 years and in a different way. So what's your view of the modernity of Ireland as it stands?
Well, I think like most changes, some are for the better and some you need to be careful you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And because there has been certainly a dominance of one view in the past, what you don't want is for the pendulum to swing the other way and be a dominance of another view. We struggle all the time, you know, to be respectful of each other's differing beliefs, differing understandings. I've tried that all my life, you know, and to be respectful of other people, because that's how I was raised. And, you know, when I meet someone, I don't ask, what do you believe? And I want to meet you as a person. And if I like you as a person, it doesn't really matter to me if you think differently to me. I just love you as a friend.
And just on this subject, finally, as a person of faith, were you very hurt by some of the revelations of the indiscretions of what happened within the church?
No, devastated. Really devastated. But, you know, that touched in my own life. As you know, there were false allegations made about my brother and about me. And they were believed by many people and they were printed and left up there in online sites for many years. And that was a terrible, terrible experience that I'm still trying to work my way through, Joe.
Okay.
And I know how terrible that is because it could have happened to anybody. you know, just I was well known, and I was in the middle of a presidential election, and for whatever reasons people did it, they did it. But like Cliff Richard, who's a good friend for many years, mm-hmm. he suffered that.
Outrageous.
Paul Gambaccini suffered that. And they've been very supportive to me. But it's a terrible, terrible thing to happen. And maybe we all need to take a little breath before we actually believe all that we see or all
indeed,
that we hear.
Indeed. Well, I may not particularly be a big fan of Donald Trump, but he does talk about fake news, and there is an awful lot of fake news out there. I want to get on to your current music, Diana, and you're still making music, your album. Tell us about some of the songs in that.
Well, My Time is an album that was unexpected in my life. The producer of my nieces and nephews, the Rua, Bob Rose, is a man who started, he was in the studio when the Beach Boys were doing God Only Knows. He worked with, as a young man, with Phil Spector. He's worked with everyone, George Harrison, the Traveling Wilburys, all the way through. He asked him, would I be interested in recording it? And I said no. And part of that was because I was really traumatized by what had happened here with the false allegations. And I'd really retreated from the world. I just felt safe in my home and I didn't want to go out. And for a year I said no. And then he came with three songs which were written or co-written by my nieces and nephew. And one of them with Rob Davis. Do you remember Rob Davis out of Mud? He wrote hits for Kylie since mm-hmm. then, but yes. He's a big writer, and they co-wrote a song together. And I went very, treading very gently into the studio. He uses a studio in Rome called Musica Forum, where Ennio Morricone did all his epic yes. soundtracks.
The Mission and...
You walk in there and you can feel it in the air. And I recorded with amazing musicians, stars. I mean, from Tears for Fears and Oasis and High Flying Birds and Jimi Hendrix Experience yes. and the bass player from Blondie who wrote One Way or Another. Mm. Come on, Joe, I'm going to get you.
You're the singer. You're the singer.
I mean, I was very intimidated walking in, and we settled down and we were just musicians in a room. We just bonded as musicians and we bonded as people. We did the three songs and then they said, will you do another seven? And so I did. I mean, I'm looking at the album and I can't believe that it's there, but I mm-hmm. think it's one of the most enjoyable, once I got over the initial fear, and also I think it's one of the best things I've done in my career.
Tana, do you know, I could talk to you for another hour, but I'm just looking at the clock and we've come to the end, so I'm going to ask you to pick another piece of music and maybe pick a track off your album as well. But listen, I have to say, I could go on forever, and I didn't even touch on half the things I wanted to talk to you about, but it's been so interesting.
I've loved talking to you, Joe.
So tell me about your...
Well, all of the songs are like babies to me. I love them all. Mm-hmm. Some are original, and I'm going to pick a cover version. And it was an unexpected song for me to sing. It's Roxy Music, Just Like You. You'll hear the wonderful playing of Danny on the guitar. He's the Jimi Hendrix Experience of today.
Wow.
And there's a Dixieland trad sound in there, but it just is amazing. It's like a painting. This song recording is like a painting to me. And there's one little bit where you'll hear my niece Alana sing, and I'm whispering the words behind her. And it just makes me think of walking down King's Road or Carnaby Street in the 70s. There's a real feel about this whole thing. And apparently, Brian Ferry likes it, so
okay, well,
that's great.
He can't say fairer than that. Well, listen, I have to say a big, big thank you. Thanks for coming into the studio. It's been fascinating. So this is Diana from the album My Time with the Roxy Music song entitled...
Just Like You.
Buttercups, daisies and most anything. Blossom in spring. Time conquers innocence, pride. So seasons will change just like you.